From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, the 2nd of December 2008. The Supreme Court prepares to rule on whether power plants can favor financial impacts over environmental concerns. We'll hear how state capitals are bracing for decreased revenues during the financial crisis. And the Taliban says it's been selling U.S. hardware to help fund their troops. I'm Aura Bogado. Stay tuned for that and more after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Ford Motor Company submitted recovery plans to Congress today, asking for a $9 billion share of auto industry loan money, but doesn't think it will need to use it. The automaker says it's solvent and has enough cash on hand to get through the year. Plan details include no bonuses for management employees next year, no merit raises for North American salaried employees in 2009, slashing 606 dealers, and cutting in half major suppliers. Ford also released sales figures today that show a nearly one-third drop last month. GM and Chrysler are due to submit plans later today, and hearings are scheduled for Thursday and Friday. An Israeli airstrike in Gaza today killed a pair of teenage brothers and wounded four others as Gaza-based political factions began deliberations over the fate of an Egyptian-brokered ceasefire deal with Israel. Free Speech Radio News' Rami El-Maghari reports.
The Israeli raid on Gaza came just hours after armed Palestinians responded to an Israeli ground attack on eastern Rafah. Earlier in the day, Israeli tanks rolled about 200 meters into Palestinian-owned territory. According to witnesses, the brothers were struck outside their homes as Israeli troops attacked their neighborhood. The Israeli army confirms the airstrike but says it targeted a group of militants who fired mortar shells against the troops in southern Gaza, according to Israeli media sources. This airstrike comes as Israel warns of a large-scale military offensive on Gaza in a bid to stop homemade rocket fire from Gaza into nearby Israeli towns. The Israeli army attacked Gaza early last month. Gaza-based factions responded with homemade rocket fire. Meanwhile, the ruling Hamas party in Gaza began holding meetings today with other armed factions to discuss the fate of a six-month ceasefire deal with Israel that was brokered by Egypt in June. For more than 3 weeks now, Israel has sealed Gaza's border crossings, denying movement of people and goods alike. Many say a humanitarian crisis is looming in the coastal region. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami El-Maghari in Gaza.
Thailand's Prime Minister Somchai Wongsawat resigned his post today after a high court ruling yesterday that dissolved the country's top three political parties. The Constitutional Court banned Wongsawat from politics for 5 years. Deputy Prime Minister Chandirakul will assume the role of caretaker prime minister. Protesters say they will end what has been weeks of demonstrations that closed the capital's airports and stranded 300,000 travelers. Passenger flights are expected to begin again on Friday. Cargo flights resumed today. A federal jury has cleared oil giant Chevron of colluding with Nigerian military forces to suppress protests. Africa Jones reports.
The jury found that the Nigerian government was responsible for the violence, which led to at least one death. In 1998, indigenous groups took over one of Chevron's platforms in Nigeria to protest the destruction of freshwater, farmlands, and fishing caused by oil drilling. Richard Hertz is senior attorney for Earth Rights International, one of the groups representing the plaintiffs in the case.
We're very disappointed in the ruling. I think, though, that just the fact that we were able to bring it to trial and a judge found that we had enough evidence for us to proceed before a jury sends a message to Chevron that it can't commit abuses like this without the world finding out about it. Chevron is using the military on an ongoing basis in an improper way. This is the military that they're paying to be their security despite knowing about their brutal conduct.
Earth Rights International has another case against Chevron in California State Court and says it will appeal this ruling. A similar lawsuit against Royal Dutch Shell, claiming the company was complicit in human rights abuses, including the death of environmentalist Ken Saro-Wiwa, will begin in New York in February. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Africa Jones.
President Bush has blocked collective bargaining rights for some federal employees. In an executive order signed yesterday, Bush excluded 8,600 select positions at the Justice, Homeland Security, Treasury, Transportation, and Energy departments from bargaining rights afforded in the Civil Service Reform Act of 1978. And voters in Georgia are at the polls today to decide a runoff election that could bring Democrats within one vote of a filibuster-proof supermajority in the U.S. Senate. Incumbent Republican Senator Saxby Chambliss faces Democrat Jim Martin. Turnout so far today has been moderate, with 533,000 voters casting early ballots. The final seat for a 60-vote majority in the Senate is still up for grabs, the race in Minnesota between Republican Senator Norm Coleman and Al Franken. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
The Supreme Court heard a case today on the Clean Water Act and whether power plants are able to opt out of retrofitting their structures to comply with regulations if they think the financial impact trumps the environmental benefits. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
The case is three cases rolled into one. Energy Corporation, PSEG Fossil, and Utility Water Act Group, all utility providers, are caught up in a legal battle with the environmental group Riverkeeper. At issue, bodies of water that act as cooling mechanisms for power plants that are home to aquatic life, specifically plankton and other water organisms. The Clean Water Act says power plants have to update their technology to comply with environmental regulations. But the utility companies say the Clean Water Act allows them to conduct a cost-benefit analysis before complying. The Nuclear Energy Institute, or NEI, filed an amicus brief on behalf of the plaintiffs. 60 of 100 nuclear power plants would be affected by the ruling. Stephen Karakis is a spokesperson for NEI. He says upgrades could cost up to hundreds of millions of dollars.
I don't know that we've run any kind of actual numbers on it because that's all going to vary company to company and site to site, but it certainly would be a potentially a considerable expense. Folks should keep in mind that, nuclear power plants provide 20% of the nation's electricity supply.
But environmentalists, including the respondent Riverkeeper, say Congress intended business to update technology to comply with environmental standards, despite the cost. They point to Congress's words, quote, best technology available. David Bookbinder is chief environmental counsel for the Sierra Club, which filed an amicus brief supporting Riverkeeper.
The Clean Water Act does not say anything about cost-benefit analysis.
Bookbinder goes on to say that the environmental cost is great.
Power plants that suck about 200 billion gallons of water a day out of our lakes and rivers and streams and use that once, just once, to cool their facilities and then discharge that water.
The High Court heard oral arguments today. Liberal-leaning Justice Souter asked the attorney representing the utility companies in conducting a cost-benefit analysis how to quantify how much money 1,000 plankton in a lake are worth. Conservative Justice Sam Alito asked the attorney representing Riverkeeper what Congress's words best available means. Alito used a real estate allegory in his question. He said the best house available to buy cost $50 million, but it doesn't mean he could afford it. The Supreme Court could decide if a cost-benefit analysis is acceptable in determining complicity in environmental regulations by late spring. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Trouble is brewing for state capitals around the country as a result of the economic meltdown, and as tax revenues drop, some states face the burden of layoffs and deciding which services to cut. President-elect Barack Obama says his economic recovery plan will include tax cuts and increased federal spending, along with an aid package to help hard-hit states. Robert Ward is the deputy director of the Rockefeller Institute of Government. He explains some of the cuts some states are already facing.
You can look at any number of states. For example, here in New York, Governor Patterson has already directed his state agencies to cut their budgets for this current year by 3% or more. That may not sound like a lot, but it does have real impacts. Some of their state parks are not open as much as they normally would be. We've seen the closure of community reentry programs for individuals who are coming out of prison trying to rejoin society. Some of the City University of New York and State University of New York campuses are reducing courses and other programs. Healthcare is a major cost center for every state government. Out in California, they're talking about freezing enrollment in their children's health insurance program. In some other states, they have already made some cuts in their Medicaid programs. So it really goes across the board. And kind of the starting point that folks need to realize, and many may not, is that state governments in this country really are the major providers of services, including health care, education, public protection, transportation services, and others that in many cases are carried out by local governments, cities, towns, and so on, but to a large extent are funded and directed by state governments. So what that tells us is that when states start having financial problems, ultimately it can mean a major change in the nature of services and the amount that taxpayers and consumers pay for them.
Some states, at least so far, are certainly faring better than others. What can they learn from the states that are already in a serious crunch?
Well, I think one lesson that states need to learn is that when there are good times and the dollars are rolling in, you need to be a little more careful than many states have been in the past. If we go back over the last decade or the last 20 or 30 years, the economy in some ways has become more volatile. We have sharper up periods, and therefore we have sharper down periods in terms of the revenues that states get from their income taxes, their sales taxes, and so on. The reason right now that, and Governor Patterson in New York has said this very clearly, the reason that New York State faces a big budget gap is largely that the expenditure side of the budget went up at two or three times the rate of inflation. If nothing were changed, the state would be spending about 9% more next year than it will this year, and that's just unsustainable. Out in California, I think the same thing has been true. Both California and New York rely very heavily on their personal income tax, and when the financial markets were very strong, both of those states reaped many, many billions of dollars in new revenue. Now that the financial sector has been hammered in so many different ways, both New York and California have seen their revenues from the income tax plummet. Here in New York, again, Governor Patterson is estimating he's losing $4 billion in the coming year compared to what was originally expected. So those are big dollar numbers. And again, what states need to do, I think, is kind of even out their spending over the longer term, so that in a real strong economic time, perhaps you moderate the rate of spending growth so that when the inevitable downturn comes, you can have some dollars in reserve that you can use to get yourself through that tough period.
Robert Ward is the deputy director of the Rockefeller Institute of Government. The Government Accountability Office says that over the next 10 years, the budget picture for states across the country will become even more problematic than it is today. The revenue structure for many states is unlikely to grow as much as the costs for healthcare, education, transportation, and other services. You're listening to FSRN. Several countries are expected to ratify a treaty in Oslo, Norway tomorrow to ban cluster munitions, the controversial explosive devices still used by many armies across the world. As Sam Greenspan reports from Washington, the U.S. is not expected to take part in the accord.
Cluster munitions are infamous for the humanitarian toll they inflict. Exploding over a large blast radius, cluster munitions don't discriminate between military and civilian targets. Additionally, individual clusters often fail to explode on impact, effectively turning the bomb site into a live minefield. This further endangers civilians, leaving the landscape hazardous and unsuitable for any use. Jeff Abramson is managing editor of Arms Control Today. He says that cluster munitions were invented to fight a war with Eastern Europe that never happened.
The original idea behind cluster munitions was to be able to fight large tank formations or large troop formations that were coming across a field. It wasn't as important that you knew exactly where they would land as long as they hit this mass. So that war never occurred and is unlikely to occur in the future. The United States still maintains a large stockpile of those weapons.
The U.S. has used cluster munitions in several countries, including Iraq, and refuses to sign the convention banning the weapons. Senators Patrick Leahy and Dianne Feinstein submitted a resolution to the U.S. Congress last June, though it did not pass due to objections from the Pentagon, which says that cluster munitions still have strategic value. The military plans to restrict use of cluster bombs to those with a fail rate of less than 1% by 2018, but Jeff Abramson sees a problem with this, mainly in that meeting this benchmark is next to impossible.
Cluster munitions should explode as intended 99% of the time or more. So the idea is to get to this 1% or less failure rate. It's an exceedingly hard goal to reach, and the U.S. and other countries, I think, are having great difficulty meeting it, which is part of what the debate is around.
The impetus for a cluster munitions ban came in 2006 when Israel launched more than 1 million cluster bombs into Lebanon, many of which came from the U.S. At present, sale and transfer of cluster munitions with fail rates of more than 1% to other countries is prohibited, though the ban will be up for renewal in the 2009 fiscal year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sam Greenspan.
Authorities in India continue to point the finger at Pakistan-based groups for last week's terrorist attack, which claimed the lives of nearly 200 people in the commercial capital of Mumbai. Tension is growing as Pakistan denies involvement, and the standoff is threatening what was a budding peace process between the two regional nuclear powers. Bismila Jilani has more from New Delhi.
"22-year-old Gautam had left for Mumbai just a few months ago to work as a trainee in the Taj Hotel. Today, when his dead body arrived in Faridabad in suburban Delhi, the entire locality is dumbfounded. Shanti, Gautam's mother, refuses to accept the body. She wants her son back alive. Gautam is among the hundreds of people who fell victim to a group of 10 heavily armed militants in India's commercial capital, Mumbai, last Wednesday. Armed militants killed nearly 200 people. More than 300 others were wounded in the attacks. India has been the target of a series of terror strikes in recent months, but this attack has left the entire nation shell-shocked and angry with their leaders. Aisha is a Mumbai resident.
Our own politicians are tearing us apart all the time, and we're allowing it in so many ways, and it's unbearable. If they are to come here, I think they would be killed today, because the public is fed up with them. We're fed up with their rhetoric. We're just fed up.
While Mumbai is limping back to normalcy, the political fallout of the attack is just beginning. Raghav Sharma is a research officer at the New Delhi-based Institute of Peace and Conflict Studies.
We can already feel the ripples of the Mumbai attack on Indo-Pak relations, because the government is already considering suspending a ceasefire that's held for about 5 years. And, you know, there is a talk of potential troop deployment along the border and suspension of rail and air links. So the peace process has already taken, you know, a few steps backward.
The investigators say the militants were Pakistanis trained by Pakistan's intelligence agency, the ISI, to carry out this attack. The Indian government on Monday officially demanded action against what they call the elements in Pakistan behind the attack. Raghav Sharma agrees with the government's move.
Pakistan is responsible for, breeding these terrorist groups, because they gave state patronage to these groups, and this is something everybody knows. I think it's time the government of India acted and conveyed a tough message that this will simply not be tolerated. Relations cannot carry on as normal unless certain concrete steps are taken.
Pakistan, however, has denied any involvement in the attack. Earlier, Prime Minister Gilani had agreed to send the Director General of the ISI to India to help the investigators, but the Pakistani authorities have since changed their mind. Zafar Jaspal, Islamabad-based strategic affairs expert, says it was in retaliation to the accusatory statements by India.
The Pakistan government was ready to send the DGSI, but now when the belligerent statements start coming out and the threatening statements start coming out of the Indian officials, then certainly the government of Pakistan has to review it, and they have to think that whether we can cooperate or for which limit of that they can cooperate.
Many feel that it's unfair to accuse Pakistan for the attacks at a time when the country itself is a target of the terrorist groups. Javed Naqvi is a political analyst.
Pakistan has got Benazir bumped off. Did the government do it? Pakistan has just had a Marriott hotel incident. Did the government do it? Did the army do it? Why can't you see Bombay, Marriott and Benazir's assassination and the bombing of the attack on Serena Hotel in Kabul? Why can't you see them as a cluster of events and with a common route? What do we need? India and Pakistan to have a fight or to come together?
But defense analyst Satinder Singh Saini argues there is enough evidence of Pakistan's involvement in various acts of terrorism, and the country must now respond positively.
Pakistan at the moment is facing existential problems. Even the international community now understands that Pakistan is the fountainhead of terrorism, which is actually affecting not only the South Asian region, but the entire world. So it'll be in the interest of Pakistan to actually take whatever Indian concerns are seriously and change its policy of using terrorism as an instrument of its foreign policy.
Saini, however, is against any measures that would jeopardize the fragile peace between the two nuclear neighbors.
Strong signal which the people are clamoring for is more of a result of anger in the immediate aftermath of the terrorist incident which has occurred. I think we should allow the dust to settle down, think rationally and in a mature manner, and then proceed abrogating the ongoing ceasefire at this moment is not a rational step.
With the growing tensions between India and Pakistan, some raise questions about the possibility of a nuclear war. Both countries have nuclear weapons, but Javed Naqvi rules out such a scenario, saying that a war between the two will deal a severe blow to the United States campaign in Afghanistan, which the United States will never allow to happen.
The ruling classes in both countries are completely beholden to Washington, D.C. I mean, under normal circumstances, this would be a point for criticism, but at the moment, it comes as a huge relief that at least somebody wields the stick or the clout to tame these two from, crossing the threshold, and both of them are nuclear powers.
While things might not get out of control, the uncertainty is bound to hover over the subcontinent for some time, given the political compulsions in India. The Manmohan Singh government is already under attack by the Hindu nationalists, who accuse him of being soft on terror. And in an election year, the image of being soft on Pakistan might cost him dearly politically. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
Pakistani military troops killed at least 6 militants in the country's northwest region after militants attacked a convoy in the Swat Valley. One soldier also died in the conflict. Meanwhile, the Taliban, which has grown in strength, is claiming they're funding their resistance by selling U.S. hardware in Pakistan's frontline city of Peshawar. FSRN's Masroor Hussein reports.
American and NATO military hardware is shipped to the southern port city of Karachi. From there, it is taken by a road to Afghanistan. The convoys passing through Pakistan are usually safe, but as they enter the tribal areas, their safety is not guaranteed. Tribal areas are governed by the Taliban and tribal groups. Taliban leader Hakimullah spoke to FSRN in the tribal area of Aurakzai.
Container Afghanistan jaate hai.
American military supply trucks to Afghanistan pass through the tribal areas. We simply stop the container trucks carrying the weapons. We sell the plundered stuff, and that's how we meet our war expenses. In the last 10 days, we looted a huge cache worth around 60 to 70 million. We were informed about these American containers passing through our territory, so we set up an ambush and took them away. When we cracked open the containers, we found two Humvee vehicles in them.
At a sprawling market named Karkhano on the outskirts of Peshawar, vendors sell the goods stolen from American and NATO trucks. People call it Bush Bazaar. Most of the customers who visit the Bush Bazaar on the outskirts of Peshawar are Pakistan Army guys looking for latest military gadgets like the GPS locators, trackers, night vision goggles, daggers and pistols. But many come here with families to buy other looted items for souvenirs like jackets, blankets, socks, boots, chairs, beds and CDs. Tribal elder Wali Khan Afghani is president of Karkhano Sellers Association.
Bulletproof jackets, small arms like pistols, and other stuff like field goggles, night vision, binoculars, different types of casings. Our customers include soldiers. The other day I sold over 300 different military items. Taliban plunder the Allied forces' containers, and we buy guns and other things from them. But tribes who are not Taliban also plunder the passing through containers and sell the booty to us.
Many in Peshawar question the vulnerability of the world's best armies besieged in neighboring Afghanistan and the helplessness of their closest ally, Pakistan. Safiullah Gul is a journalist and comes from North Waziristan.
Even the federal government, what it can do is just carry out army operations, but properly on land, if we talk about land operations, it seems that they don't have a writ over there because suddenly it is a no-go area for them. Even the U.S. forces are unable to carry out land operations in Afghanistan. The same will be the case in this mountainous terrain. Taliban, now they are having a total control.
The Bush Bazaar operating for the last 7 years is a clear sign that things are not going well for the U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan. And with President-elect Obama and Secretary of State Clinton suggesting troops build up in Afghanistan, the shop owners say they are happy about the potential increase in sales. Masroor Hussain, Free Speech Radio News, Peshawar.
And now a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
More money for masters, none for you. As the nation's economy seesaws between bubble and bust, people are becoming more and more aware of the obscene levels of disproportion between average workers and their CEOs. During congressional hearings where businessmen begged while politicians lectured, much was made of the costs of private jets used to carry them to Washington. But this was actually a pittance when one considers the rarely discussed issue of executive compensation. When we look at 12 of the world's most advanced economies, the U.S. is head and shoulders above all others in pay ratios between CEOs and average workers. In 2006, the average CEO made 364 times more than the average worker. As amazing as this sounds, this was down substantially from 2000, when CEOs made 525 times more than the average worker. In 2007, it was 344 times more than the average worker. It's hard to resist the temptation that business is just a machine, a money-making machine, to benefit the CEO, the board, their cronies, occasionally shareholders, and least of all, employees. It is precisely this machine that built the subprime problems, the foreclosure plague, and the present economic repercussions of the latest bursting bubble of wild speculative greed, while paying CEOs fortunes fit for kings. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
And that will do it for today's newscast. You've been listening to FSRN, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. And our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Puck Lowe and Rose Katabchi. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.